So, this evening brings to a conclusion the five-part series that we begun on the subject of what I call Earth Sila. Sila is the collective word in Buddhist teachings for fruition, for bringing the practice of the Buddha's teachings to life in daily life.
Isn't that a Jewish term too?
It might be. Is anyone of the Jewish persuasion available to enlighten us on that?
In the Old Testament, it's...
Yes. Oh, yes. Right. Right. I think it's an affirmation of some kind. Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you. So, of the eight aspects of the Eightfold Path, of Buddha's teachings on how to bring to an end the kind of self-inflicted suffering that comes along with certain activities and habits of mind. He taught the meditative qualities of concentration, of mindfulness, of the cultivation of effort, wise effort, to make meditation possible. Out of that meditative practice, certain wisdom factors begin to arise. It's why they call it insight meditation. One begins to develop insights into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are up to this moment in time. And the other wisdom factor being right intention, developing insights into our intentions that will determine, if we act upon them, who we will be in the immediate future. And whether we will speak and act in ways that either lead to the cessation of our suffering and that of others, or to its perpetuation. And the last three aspects of the Eightfold Path are collectively referred to as Sila, and it has three aspects. One is right, wise, or beneficial speech. The second, wise or beneficial individual actions. And the third aspect is most commonly or traditionally translated or referred to as right livelihood. But as we'll discuss this evening, that aspect of the teachings is very much broader than simply how one earns a living. And in fact, the very meaning of the word really takes on a different understanding when it's interpreted by contemporary scholars of the Pali language. So over the course of this series, I've been suggesting some ways of applying the Buddha's teachings on right speech, action, livelihood, to our relationships with all life, our relationships to the earth and all sentient beings. Okay. The Buddha taught, you know, his teachings on karma, or the relationship between cause and effect, is that he said, properly understood, our actions are our relations. They define how we relate to others. And he said, our actions are our protection, which is to say that if we act with beneficial intention, then we are protected from the harms that might be associated with our own ill-considered behavior. Doesn't mean that we might not experience harms as a result of the malice of another, but we will not experience harms based upon our own malfeasance, our own having spoken or acted unskillfully in the past. And so in that way, he says, if you're careful, if you're caring in the way that you comport yourself in the world, if you live with integrity, okay, then that protects you from the kinds of harms that are associated with not having done so. So that's why in this series I call Earth Sila about living the Buddha's teachings in our environmental relations. Okay, so that to the extent that we understand how it all works, perhaps if us and a few billion others start doing it as well, we can live in a way that protects us instead of destroying the planet, right? So that's the general idea. And of course, it's kind of a long-term process. And in terms of applying the teachings of Sila, what I've done is to translate them, Earth Sila for our purposes, into four different program areas and areas of teaching. The first one being and based or grounded in the Buddha's teachings on wise, right, beneficial communication. A look at environmental discourse. How do we speak about the environment? How do we assess what we hear others saying when they speak about the environment? To what extent is environmental speech, ours or others, got any discernible relationship at all with the Buddha's teachings on what constitutes right speech? In terms of whether it is beneficially intended, whether it is useful, whether it is truthful, whether it is timely, and whether it is kind. So that's a rich and an ongoing realm of inquiry. Where do we go for information about the environment? What does it have to say to us? Do we tend to just kind of consume whatever comes our way from the commercial media? Or do we try to seek out, you know, in Clay Johnson's little book, The Information Diet, we start to get more choosy about the kinds of information we consume. Because the kinds of information we consume tend to color, in some cases actually create, our view of how the world is and what's going on. In terms of individual actions, what I've done is to apply that to the Buddha's teachings, the five precepts for laypersons, okay, for householders, in terms of trying honoring life and seeking to avoid killing. And that involves waking up, inquiring more deeply into what died so that we might live. Okay, from the understanding that because their rules for not killing living beings were based upon the two criteria for what constitutes a living being of some form of consciousness and respiration. And modern science tells us that plant life, just as surely as animal life, demonstrates many different forms of what might be called sentience and consciousness. And of course, it also respires. Because if green plants didn't respire, we wouldn't be either, right? Because we have this trade-off going off in terms of the gases we intake and the gases we expel. The precept of not taking that which is given. You know, the precept of not exploiting others for our own sense gratification, harming others for the purpose of sense gratification, sexual misconduct. Okay. And taking all these into account, pulling them together under the heading of consumption and clear-mindedness. What are the ways we try to stay asleep to the effects of our consumption? What are the ways that we choose to try not to acknowledge the effect of our consumption? Waking up to how much of whatever it is that we consume. Looking at how patterns of consumption are distributed throughout society and throughout the world. Those who have enough healthy food to eat and those who don't, and why. Looking at the waste of food. Looking at trying to make healthy food more affordable to people who have difficulty finding it. Okay. Trying to tune into taking only that which we need, distinguishing between wants and needs. Okay. And this form of program activity that I want to focus on tonight is one that I'm calling energy flow and way of life. Okay.
I'm sorry, energy flow.
Energy flow and way of life. Okay. How do I get from right livelihood to way of life? The translation of the Pali word ajiva. Associated with the seminary program that I went through a few years ago at Spirit Rock in order to be able to do this Dharma teaching, there is a wonderfully skilled scholar of the Pali language who I got to know and became friends with, John Kelly in Australia, who after a successful career went back and got a a graduate degree in Pali language studies, so he could be among those who is going back and having a very close look at the various translations of the Pali canon that are out there. The Pali canon, the Pali language, is the first written language in which the Buddha, what the historical Buddha is thought to have said. It's been recorded, put down on paper, and then first translated in the late 1800s by scholars who were doing their best at the time using the late Victorian English of the time and the scholastic language of the Church of England at the time to render these translations. And so now we have a whole generation of modern scholars who are going back and looking very closely at the Pali language and seeing if they can come up with meanings that more precisely convey what we think the Buddha was trying to get across. It's what in law we call legislative intent. What was really on the Buddha's mind. And so I wrote him when I was preparing this series of talks, and I said, you know, all of the other seven aspects of the Eightfold Path seem quite universal. And they seem as if they're really intended for everybody. Okay. But that this one, right livelihood, somehow it sounds like it only appeals to, it only applies to wage earners, you know. And he said, right, that's a real problem with the original translation. And so what he wrote me was this. He said, there is nothing in the Pali word ajiva that implies just wage earners. Okay. Various Pali English dictionary definitions include livelihood, mode of living, living, subsistence. So to me, it encompasses what we do to sustain ourselves and how we use the resources we have, which really covers a very wide range. And he said, and as you succinctly put it, how one makes one's way in the world. Okay. And so that is how I'm interpreting this word ajiva, okay, of basically our way of life, how we go about making our decisions in terms of material subsistence in the world. Okay. It encompasses and includes the notion of livelihood, for sure, but there's a lot more to it than that. So in terms of these different kinds of energy flows, the two I really want to focus on this evening are the energy of wealth, where our wealth comes from, how we use it, and where it goes, as if in a grand circulatory system. And then also the question literally of our energy needs. For what purposes do we use energy? Whether it's from fossil fuels or other sources, what needs does it help us meet? Okay. Where does that energy come from? Are what are the different means by which it might be obtained? What are the different means by which it might be used? And what happens at the back end of the energy cycle? Okay. So those are all issues I want to at least touch upon this evening. And then near the end of our time together, I'd like to talk with you about how we might, I want to brainstorm with you a little bit about what an ongoing program of Earth Sila study and action might look like. Not only in our sangha, but others in the Front Range as well. So, within this realm of making one's way in the world, okay, the Buddha did in fact have a certain amount to say about livelihood, about how one earns one's living. And what he basically said, as with everything else, is be careful how you do it. Be careful how you come by, how you generate the wealth on which you depend. He said there is a small category of ways of making one's way in the world, of generating one's wealth, that are like the growing of poison fruit. And that if you use your energy in such a way as to cause that kind of fruition, you will poison your own future karma, as well as causing considerable harm to others. So he's, and he had a pretty short list, and it included things, and a list of examples. And it had to do with things like the manufacture and sale of weapons, okay. Slave trade, marketing intoxicants that cause people to become heedless and do bad things. Okay. Basically, what he was saying was that any way of life, any way of earning a living that has the effect of directly harming or systemically harming other human beings is to be avoided. Not only for the harm that you do others, but for the harm that you are doing to your own future self. And here it doesn't matter, you know, whether you're into, you know, future lives or whatnot, what it does to you in the moment, what it does to your consciousness, what it does to your relationships with others. Okay. What it does to your relationship to yourself. So he's saying be mindful of that. Okay. And he also then said, and aside from these few forms of living that cause positive harms to others as well as to yourself if you engage in them, beyond that, it really doesn't matter so much what you do as it does how you do it. And in one address to a fairly well-off householder who is raising this question kind of delicately, I think, you know, well, how do you feel about people that have a lot of money? How do you feel about the distribution of wealth in society? Okay, is there anything innately sort of suspect about being wealthy or inherently pure or noble about not being so? The Buddha said, you know, whether you have a lot or a little, okay, the two things that really matter is how you came by it. So when he talked about righteous labor, he said, labor done, work done, effort expended with integrity, and how you expend it, how you use your wealth. And he said the noble ways or the useful ways to use your wealth are to see to your own basic needs and the needs of those who depend upon you. They lived in fairly calamitous times. The Buddha was very, you know, it was a pretty rambunctious period in Northeast Indian history. And so he said, be mindful of calamities that exist out there. Oh, like maybe forest fires and floods and whatnot. Be ready to expend your wealth, you know, to prepare for such things, both for yourself and others, so you can be safe, right? Honor those who have helped get you where you are. Okay. It was another way to use your wealth. Okay. Acknowledge and support your spiritual benefactors. You know, people kind of wondered about that. Well, that sounds a little self-serving, you know, but at the time, and it is still the case to a remarkable degree, the Buddha Dharma Sanghas, the Sanghas of monastics throughout the world, are supported by nothing other than contributions. So I was saying, if you want the Dharma to stay alive, okay, then you might want to consider providing a sufficient support for this, for these teachings to continue to be shared. So essentially, at the bottom line was, he was saying, practice generosity. Okay, whether you have a lot or little, make sure that, you know, first off, that the flow of wealth coming to you is not tainted. That it did not come to you in a morally compromised way, in a way that caused harm, that caused suffering to others. And then make sure that you expend it in ways that likewise have integrity, okay, that meet your basic needs, those of others, that are expended in a caring way, you know, that kind of help your community, as including your spiritual community. And that's basically it, you know. That's how you participate in this circulatory system of wealth. And here he's talking about wealth as a form of karma. Okay. So for us today, regardless of how we make our way in the world, the same rules apply. Okay. So our sources of sustenance, material sustenance in terms of money and whatnot, they may be from wages, may be income from interest. It may be a social program of some form, okay? Whether it's unemployment insurance or supplemental security income or a Social Security disability benefit or pension. It may be Social Security payments upon retirement. Okay, these are all ways in which wealth comes to us. And so, for me, at one point, I was thinking, well, you know, I'm earning it. What I do more or less falls into the right livelihood category. You know, I teach and try to do my best at it and whatnot. But then it became time to have a closer look at where our wealth really comes from. And in our case, my wife and I were fortunate enough to inherit some funds, you know, not millions, but, you know, enough to warrant investing it wisely and having somebody to advise us and how to do so. And the last time we met with her, she was saying, well, you know, your portfolio is looking pretty good. Okay. And especially, darn, look at those energy stocks. And my breath kind of caught. There is, at this point in time, certainly in the United States and a lot of the West, a divestment movement going on. And it's very much like the divestment movement that is widely acknowledged with having brought apartheid to an end in South Africa. Okay. Where little bit by little bit, you know, the cover story had always been, oh yeah, well, you know, we've got to keep investing in businesses that do business with South Africa because, you know, behind the scenes they're kind of doing their best for social change and you can't really cause change to occur in a, you know, in an overtly racist society like that if you're not engaged and whatnot. And at some point in this country and elsewhere, people just started saying, you know, that's not true. That doesn't get it anymore. You know, that's a horribly morally compromised argument. And so stockholders and major corporations throughout the United States and other parts of the world started demanding that those companies start pulling out of South Africa. They started demanding of their investment portfolios that you don't loan money to companies that are doing business in South Africa as long as apartheid is perpetuated. And eventually, it came to an end. Came to an end for a lot of reasons. It came to an end because of the concerted efforts of South Africans, mostly black, some white, who worked for generations to bring it to an end. It came to an end because eventually there was a change of heart in the government. But it also came to an end because there was enormous global financial pressure put on that government to end apartheid. And the same thing's going on right now with investment in fossil fuel energy stocks. And it comes from the same kind of recognition that what's going on right now is enough of a genuine crisis that is increasing in scope and in scale and in pace that the only way that we stand a chance of really reining it in is to try to get our fossil fuel consumption back to some earlier point in time. It's where it's a little bit more sustainable and where the Earth's systems are more capable of dealing with the amount of CO2 that's being generated, because right now, that's not true. It's absolutely unsustainable. It's getting much worse, much faster. And the only way to start to put the brakes on there to turn around a little bit is to begin to pull away from enjoying the wealth that that form of industrial activity has while trying to pretend it's not having the environmental effects that it is. Okay. And so, both personally as well as institutionally, that divestment process has had to begin. Because it's like drinking seawater to quench your thirst, right? It's short-term gain at the expense of what's increasingly looking like. And the UN High Commissioner for climate change studies has just said it's getting worse faster than we thought. Okay. And it is because of fossil fuel consumption that the CO2 is building up at the rate that it is, and we have to dramatically decrease that as fast as we can in order to try to change the situation. So it's one example of, in a way that I hadn't previously thought about before, there is a source of wealth that's tainted for us in terms of how that wealth was generated. Please.
I wanted to make a comment. It kind of reminds me of years ago when I had worked with a professor in psychophysics, and we were working with the military, and the situation was such that I was making a decision where I wanted my career to go in engineering and working with corporations, that what I discovered helped bring about warfare. You know, help create ammunition like drones and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And even though I was just a little tiny piece of it, I still was cognizant and also aware that I was helping creating that path. So I said, no, I'm not doing this. My conscience won't allow me to do this. So I pulled out of working in that direction.
Yes, thank you. A friend of mine, dear Dharma friend of mine, godfather to our daughters, when he was in graduate school and then took some time off to travel to Asia with Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and that's the whole second wave of Dharma bumps, you know, before they began to teach, and did some practice in Asia, came back to resume his graduate studies, and his studies were being funded in part by a corporation that was engaged in weapons manufacturing. And he was getting pretty much a free ride through graduate school because he was a very talented guy, and they were expecting, you know, he had a job waiting for him as soon as he graduated. And then all of a sudden it was like, wow, phooey on the Dharma. You know? Now I've got to turn down the money, you know, because it just didn't feel right anymore. Okay, it became a path that he felt that he could no longer follow because he'd awakened to the effects. And he was grateful for having had the support, but he could see where it was headed. You know? So there are a lot of these ways that we're oftentimes just not that tuned into or not too aware of that bear careful consideration. You know? That's on how the funds come to us. And then there's the question of where they go, of what we spend them on, you know, of who we do and don't do business with. Yeah. At the other end, for instance, of the investment question. Okay, so we direct our wealth in ways that are trying to achieve ends for us in terms of trying to make sure we don't have to eat cat food and live under the freeway in our old age, but at the same time, not help destroy the earth while we're at it. And whether we have means or whether we don't, at the very simplest of purchases, the very simplest of decisions about where we buy our food and where it came from, and how we sustain ourselves on Earth, okay, take on a certain freshness and precision and edge to them when we start to think about them in these ways. Certainly holds true in terms of how we use energy. You know, there's a considerable row going on right now between solar technology installers, okay, like Namaste Solar and these other organizations that install rooftop solar systems on people's homes and whatnot. And thanks to some federal legislation that's been on the books for quite a long time now and sometimes gets funded and sometimes doesn't. The utility companies are compelled to buy electricity that homeowners with solar systems generate. If they generate more energy than they're using at home, then any excess energy goes back to the utility company, and the utility company is compelled to buy it at market rates. Pretty good deal for the solar equipped homes if they own their home long enough. Not such a great deal for the energy company, for the utility companies, as they're discovering, because they're not selling as much energy as they were, because they're actually having to buy it from some of their customers. Okay, so now utility companies, you know, big publicly owned utilities companies, you know, like Xcel and its parent corporation, Northern Lights Power, is in the process of fighting tooth and nail to get that mandatory buyback program terminated. Scale it way back and then end it altogether if possible. So they're coming out strongly now against the continued expansion of solar energy in the United States, because it's beginning to affect their profits in ways that they don't want to see have happen. Okay. So there are certain battles royal going on right now within the American economy and certain in American politics and law having to do with these kinds of issues. And here in Colorado, you have the opportunity, if you want to buy up to 100% of your energy wind-generated in the wind source program. There's also an effort being made on the part of the utility companies to start adding surcharges to people that are getting wind energy in order to pay for improved distribution of electricity. And with the intent, basically, of discouraging people to keep buying so much wind energy. Okay. So there is a lot in play right now in American society with regard to where our energy comes from and how we use it, how we might in the future. As I said from the very beginning, we have cause for hope and we have cause for despair, both in terms of what's happening now, because at least at the present time, both nationally and internationally, it seems like there is a headlong rush to get as much fossil fuel out of the ground as is absolutely possible now before the complete effects of its combustion are known. And so there's this race going on to get as much fossil fuel out of the ground as possible on the one hand, while others are trying to do everything they can to slow it down a little bit. So we're looking at a situation that's going to be rife with conflict for a long time to come. And the last thing I want to say with regard to this process of trying to begin to slowly turn what seems like an overwhelmingly massive and immovable object and get it moving ever so slightly in another direction. Joanna Macy, in her book Active Hope, analogized to building some of the great cathedrals in Europe and during the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, where there would be a design made and the commission for the construction that might go on for 200 or 300 years. Okay, so the people who laid the groundwork and got the project underway and originally in a business would never live to see the final product. Okay, and so I hear that story over and over again during the occasions that my wife and I had to visit some of these places in Europe, and it was always, well, that's really neat, you know, they really knew how to do things back then. And then we found ourselves in the city of Barcelona, the capital of Catalonia in northeastern Mediterranean Spain, where we lived for a while. And there is this cathedral there in Barcelona called the Sagrada Familia, Sacred Family. And it was designed by the Spanish architect, Gaudí. And it is an extraordinary building. It is laid out like a classic cathedral, but it doesn't look too much like one from the outside. And when you go into the cathedral, it has that same effect in terms of drawing the consciousness upward and giving you the feeling that, you know, you've maybe entered a heavenly realm. The stained glass windows, although they have different figures, they have animals and things and not just the saints and whatnot. The lights pouring in. The columns on the inside, however, are not classic Doric columns. They look like trees. It's like you're in a redwood forest. They reach up toward the sky and then they fan out, right? And it's like you're in this fantastic, magical forest, you know? And it's as if it's like being transported to the 23rd century or something. That cathedral was commissioned in the 1880s, right? And And one of the things I found just as astonishing as being in this magic space was the fact that a very wealthy religious society underwrote Gaudí to start building it, you know, about 130 years ago. It's astonishing. It's so futuristic and so inspiring, and so out there, so absolutely different from anything else around it. And then when we were up on the top, we were looking at, you know, what's going on in terms of the building, whatnot. They're still working on it. So it's not just back in the 14 and 1500s that people were working on these kind of projects. You know, it's 140 years and counting. or 130 years and counting with the Sagrada Familia, you know. It continues to go forward, okay. Still manifesting Gaudí's vision. And so sometimes I think about the project that we have before us in terms of trying to modify our behavior to live more sustainably, to once again learn how to help the earth sustain us, okay. It's not going to happen overnight. It took 200 years for the climate to get as messed up as it is. And the idea that it's going to take anything less than at least half that long to turn it around is probably not realistic. Not in our lifetimes, not in our children's or their children's, will the changes that need to be made come about. But in order for us to do anything positive in the moment, there has to be this belief, this faith that it's possible. That if enough of us are similarly inclined and similarly focused, that the changes that need to happen for us to return to a more sustainable relationship with the earth are indeed possible. Thank you. Let's talk. So, the ideas that I've had so far in terms of program development going forward are these. I think that we, as the Denver Sangha, the other Sanghas on the Front Range, together could initiate a program of activities, that a lot of which could be done over the internet, it wouldn't require even getting together, that could fall into the categories of things like in the environmental discourse area, having a repository, an annotated bibliography of key readings that we find to be particularly useful, of reliable information sources to go to inform ourselves about things like not killing living beings in all their regards, including the use of pesticides that kill millions of insects, you know, to make our food look nicer. That look at all the ways that other human beings suffer and sometimes die in the production of food. Okay, of looking at our habits of consumption in terms of consumption and clear-mindedness and food policy, and all the ways that we might have a closer look at how to bring a healthy, affordable food to all who need it and who want it, but can't have access to it or afford it right now. To look at how we might go about participating in what's called the great turning that needs to occur if we are to have any chance of resolving our climate crisis. So, books and other readings, information sources to go to inform ourselves about that. Thinking about also gathering information about organizations that are doing things in these realms that we might want to plug into or be a part of. And also another realm of activity devoted to activities themselves, which is to say a running calendar of any events that any of us know about that fall into one or another of these categories, activities that we might want to plug into. And this would all be run through the Insight Meditation of Community of Colorado's website. It would be a fresh entry on there. It would be a place that we could all check on, report to, and there could be members of each Sangha that would feed information into it on a regular basis. It could also be used as an organizing nexus if at some point there are any activities that we ourselves decide we might want to take up. So, what do you think? Gloria.
Is the link on the Insight website, is it already there?
No. All that's up there right now is my talks. As they're recorded, they get posted. And that's about the extent of it so far. This is all a framework for something that might occur in the future. Mm-hmm. Please, Barbara.
Yeah. That kind of information is stuff that I've been gathering and working on for the last, 6 months now. So I'm happy to work on that.
Great.
And I know there's two other people in our Dharma Games group that would be interested in doing that. I haven't heard from all of them.
Yeah, Lynn's the environmental blogger for Tattered Cover. She sends me stuff already on a regular basis. You know, there's some great stuff out there on this topic.
Yeah.
Stuff
that's
really worth reading.
She's not in the Dharma Games, but she's fellow traveler.
Yep.
I think one thing I wanted to mention is that I've been kind of immersing myself in this for a while, and as have a lot of my friends, the people that I'm kind of working with and organizations, and it's like, man, 3 months and you're hitting burnout. So, it's a very quick burnout point because there's so much information. From utilities to, environment, it's very complex, and so it's hard to, it's been hard for me to sort of pick my niche and say where can I focus, where can I fit in, where can I best use my skills.
Yes.
But there's, it's a daunting topic to do, and I think you had mentioned also at some point an affinity group. That you can't, you feel like you're doing it alone.
Yes. When back in the 1970s, when my wife and I were first really undertaking Dharma study and practice in a pretty committed way, we also were very involved with the founding of an organization called the Shanti Project, and that provided counseling and companionship for people with life-threatening illnesses and with their families. And also help people die. That's one of the things that we did. And one of the things that we quickly realized, if we were to do that work without, just as you said, very quickly coming to a burnout point, okay, what was absolutely essential in making that work possible was meeting with each other on a regular basis and sharing the stories of what we were doing. And sharing the stories of how we felt, and being witnesses for each other to the full range of emotions that we found ourselves going through, and acknowledging the precious moments as well as the difficult ones. And so, as I've been, because the same kind of burnout, kind of environmental burnout that you're talking about, has happened to me over and over again. And the only reason that I've found myself wanting to really re-engage with these issues right now, I realize the same thing as I did with the Shanti Project. There needs to be some kind of organizing nexus and support group among us as a Sangha. There are a lot of other faith communities out there that are doing the same thing with whom we can and probably should start networking. But they're discovering the same thing, that there is real power, there's psychological power in addressing these things together and sharing our feelings as we go forth. Yes, please.
One of the things that stood out, and I haven't finished the entire book, but in Act of Hope, is the that constant returning to gratitude.
Yes.
To feed the process, and maybe that's something that we can periodically address within the Sangha and with other Sanghas, however that looks, but to really pointedly get together and look at the gratitude piece to feed us.
Yes. Thank you. Absolutely instrumental, the positive aspect. And like I said at our very first talk, I find myself sometimes when I'm riding my bike down one of the parkways thanking the trees. this glorious, beautiful world that's out there. In this special magic time of year now, the fall, as the leaves are starting to turn. This is an extraordinary place. And just like someone you're falling in love with, you feel drawn to want to do what you can to help take care of it. Yeah, please.
Those of you who lived through the Reagan years remember that there was a lot of concern about nuclear weapons at that time and a lot of talk about limited nuclear war. Which was a fairly depressing concept. One of the things that we learned out of that was working with an organization called Beyond War.
Yes.
And that many times you could get really depressed with the rhetoric that was coming from the government, etc. And it didn't take a lot of action on your part. Maybe it was only getting a group of people together in your living room to talk about the issues in a constructive way to offset that feeling of depression that came from the immensity of the situation that we were confronting. So
beautiful.
Taking some small action may be very helpful.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken. Like I said at the very beginning, it's possible to think about what we may find ourselves up to here as becoming part of an environmental peace movement. You know, just the same thing, finding non-dual ways to think about, to talk about, to converse about some of the environmental challenges that we face now, how to bring the Dharma, our experience of the Dharma, our knowledge of the Dharma, skillfully to bear on these issues, which is another way, I think, to help address the burnout problem. So I will be continuing to look forward, have conversations about what we might do here by way of some kind of ongoing programmatic activity. Some kind of affinity group, I think, would be a wonderful idea. Insofar as the specifics of how we focus it or how we would structure it, how we would relate to other sanghas, I think those are things that are all yet to be explored. What I plan to do over the next few days or week or so is to commit my thoughts so far to writing, you know, what I just shared with you this evening, put it out there as a suggestion for an outline for some program development on the listserv. Welcome feedback, and then maybe refine that a little bit and see if we can use that as kind of a framework for going forward. So I appreciate everyone's attention and engagement and involvement over the time that we've been going through this series together, and I very much look forward to working with everybody who wishes to do so as we are able on these issues in the future. Let's please come to our sitting posture once again.